from KQED. Hey, hey, everyone. We are back here again from KQED Public Radio. This is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, politics reporter at KQED.
And I'm Katie Orr, very excited to be in this week for Scott Schaefer as we host something of a ladies' night here on Political Breakdown.
That's right. With Scott out of town, we have Katie here to co-host. And today's guest is a longtime political consultant and strategist who's worked a lot on women's issues, Debbie Meslow. She will be here in a bit, and we will talk to her about all those things. But first.
Oh, first. It was a busy day.
It was a busy day. It feels like every day is a busy day. But today was especially, I would say, insane on our end.
Right. In the legislature, the Appropriations Committee in both the Assembly and the Senate were taking care of their suspense files, which, if you are not familiar, they basically have hundreds of bills that they go through rapid fire and, you know, Big things can live or die within like a matter of seconds.
Yeah, for the non-capital initiated, this is kind of the place where ostensibly, you know, they decide how much things cost and if the state budget can handle it. But politically, it's really the place where bills can be killed with nobody's fingerprints or explanation on it. I would say in some ways the big news this year was how few high-profile bills died.
Yeah, I was monitoring the Senate, and they said out of like 427 bills, something like just over 100 did not make it through to the Senate floor. So that's, you know, 300-something bills that made it through that they'll have to take up here in the next few weeks before the end of the session in August 31st.
Fun time. So more busy days ahead, but we're going to go over a couple things. First and foremost, I think the biggest news of the day was probably bail reform was sort of revived from the dead after laying latent for the last year almost. This was a proposal that State Senator from Los Angeles Bob Hertzberg and Oakland Assemblyman Rob Bonta introduced over almost 2 years ago. Last year, they let it kind of sit while the governor and the chief justice of our court system asked for more time to negotiate. Today, finally, at the last 11th hour, they came out with this compromise. And some criminal justice folks who have pushed these reforms, including the ACLU, were not super stoked about it. They said that the compromise bill is essentially going to give too much power to judges. Quickly, I'll lay out what it does. It essentially is going to eliminate cash bail as of October 2019. That means you will not, if you get arrested, have a monetary amount put on your release. You would instead get evaluated by a system. And if you were in jail for, say, a minor misdemeanor, you'd basically just get let out within 12 hours. If you have a more serious charge, they'd do this risk assessment and decide, Katie, you're low risk. You can go home.
They don't
Marisa,
know me.
Marisa, you're medium risk. You need an ankle monitor, and so on. And you know, like murder charges, they probably wouldn't get released at all. So interesting one. We'll be talking about it more. Well,
it was just interesting because that was, as you mentioned, Bob Hertzberg's bill. He had another big bill, which was a measure that would create a state-backed bank for cannabis businesses. Right now, basically, because cannabis use and cannabis, like growing it, using it, is still against federal law, most banks will not have anything to do with cannabis businesses. And so they operate in cash. I mean, we're talking like millions of dollars.
I know they're paying taxes in cash.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy since legalization.
Yeah, they're talking about using armored trucks to get all this money around. So this was an attempt to set up a state-backed closed system of banks for cannabis businesses. It had been sailing through its committees and it just got shelved in the Assembly Appropriations Committee today. Hearing it was a little bit of a surprise. They weren't sure that it would go all the way, but they weren't expecting it to end today.
But as you said, that was Hertzberg's bill. And, you know, sometimes there's trade-offs, right? Like maybe Assembly looked at it and said, you know what, we're going to let SB 10, that bail bill, through. And this one we're going to hold back. Also around the criminal justice issue, police accountability bills still very much in play, including one that police and other law enforcement hate, which would essentially make it easier to prosecute police officers if they shoot and kill somebody or kill anybody in any way. This one was kind of weird procedural maneuver. They took it out of this fiscal committee, but they put it back in a rules committee. They said they're going to keep negotiating. So we're going to have to see about that. But a couple other ones around police records and body cams did make it out. And so those will come up for votes in the coming weeks. And then quickly, Katie, Me Too. We talked about this so much earlier this year.
Right.
Where's all the legislation that came out of that movement?
Well, a lot of it is still making its way through the process. A lot of it got through today, including a bill that would prohibit companies from requiring arbitration over sexual harassment disputes for employers. You basically could have the choice to like let it be adjudicated through a lawsuit versus going through arbitration. A bill that would have required hotel employees get panic buttons in case they're attacked while they're cleaning a room or something. That one actually died today. So, you know, most of the bills are being pushed forward, but there is still some resistance in some issues.
All right, great. Well, you know what? I think we should move on to Deb Meslow. I feel like we have so like much it. To talk to her about. We are going to take a short break, and after that, we will be joined by Bay Area political consultant Debbie Meslow. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Katie Orr here with Marisa Lagos and our guest this week, political strategist Debbie Meslow.
Welcome to the breakdown, Debbie.
Thank you so much. Katie and Marisa, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, so a lot of folks probably don't know who you are. You have been a consultant with Kamala Harris for a long time, an advisor to her, Barack Obama. You worked in both his campaign and his White House. And now you're doing a lot of work around criminal justice and women's voting stuff. I mean, we want to get into all that.
Yes.
I'm curious just to start, though, like, what's your thought on the bail bill?
Yes, I know. Big news, as you were saying today. And now that bail bill goes on to the assembly for a vote. You know, I think at the end of the day, look, it's going to be a great thing if California has ended the wealth-based system. You know, a lot of work I do with my clients around criminal justice are really the analysis of what's really going to keep us safe and looking against the status quo of what we've been told keeps us safe. And so at the end of the day, you know, why if someone who has money or property, you know, why should they be able to, leave their pretrial detention? And so I think it's a great thing.
So you're okay with the compromise?
I am. You know, I think that a lot of this depends on implementation and the opportunity to improve it in future cycles. And I think that there's a lot that needs to be improved. And I certainly think that there needs to be, you know, a lot of attention on that. But as far as, you know, the biggest state in the country ending wealth-based detention, I think it's a great victory.
Yeah, it's a big change. And I mean, yes. It's part of a series of criminal justice reforms. Well, and we'll talk about your work in the DA's office and all that. But let's back up. You're from Kansas.
Yes, I am.
You grew up there, went to college there.
Rock Chalk Jayhawk.
So, I mean, how, like, was politics a part of your life growing up? It's a far way from Kansas to San Francisco.
It is. It certainly is. Don't I know it? You know, it's funny. I'll tell a story. It's not really a long story, but, you know, as I was thinking today, kind of, you know, your journey and how one gets interested in politics. I'm actually an Air Force brat. So my dad was in the Air Force. We moved to Kansas when I was 12. And my parents are Republican. My family, all of them are Republican. But more of, you know, my dad believed in the military as a way of economic mobility, right? So he joined the Air Force as a way to kind of escape his childhood situation. And I had a very profound thing that happened to me when I was about 22, which is that I went to KU and graduated in journalism. I believe that journalism is a pillar of our democracy.
We do too.
I know. I like to be where the action is, and I like to be around smart people and a lot of smart journalists, you know. But when I got out, you know, the big job offer came from the Coffeeville Times, and the Coffeeville, you know, Kansas is population 2,500.
I'm like, reality hits hard.
I don't think so. And so I went to go work for the mayor of my hometown, Wichita, Kansas. Well, that was 1992, and there was this little group starting to organize called Operation Rescue, because we had some of the most liberal choice laws in the Midwest, and we actually had a doctor who really advocated, Dr. Tiller, who ended up getting murdered in his church subsequently years later. Well, so Operation Rescue targeted Wichita, right? And I worked for the mayor, and we had a city council.
Like they were trying to roll back the...
Yes, they came in. It was the first big-scale organizing effort was in Wichita, Kansas in 1992. And so it was a media hoopla, right? So for the mayor, he'd never had a press secretary. I'd never been a press secretary, so there was a lot happening. But in the middle of it, two things happened for me. Number one, I was like, this is a very important issue to me. Like this, and it still is a litmus test for me. Like, this is such an important issue to me. And then number two, the council was all white men. And they were good men, but, you know, I saw how they really grappled with some of these pressure points. So then I think, you know, early on, I just really wanted to help women represent us and, you know, made a commitment to myself that I would always look for opportunities. So I wish there was a more romantic way to say how it took me to San Francisco. I just came out for a vacation here and I was like, I must live here.
And that's pretty romantic. I don't know.
I packed up a U-Haul and I moved here in 1997. And it's been an enchanted journey ever since. But I certainly, you know, I worked at an Embarcadero fruit truck. I did a variety of things before I found it. But that was always my commitment. And I think it was that those epiphanies when I was that age. And I'm grateful I had them when I did.
So tell us then, how did you connect with Kamala Harris?
So when I moved here, I moved to Atlanta after that experience in Wichita, which was also a very fascinating journey. And then I came out for vacation after the Olympics in 96 and decided at that time I would move out. So when I did, one of the first jobs I landed with was Senator Feinstein. This was in 98 to 2000 to her reelect. And at that time, I became, acquainted with a lot of women working in politics. So actually, Kamala was at the city attorney's office then. This is when she had left the DA's office and she was working for Louise Rennie. And she started, really helping to form Emerge, which was, you know, and still is a thriving group trying to help women, pursue careers in elected office. And then she decided in 2002 that she was going to run for DA. And, you know, at that time, and you guys might remember, Marissa, I know you probably remember that it was Kamala running for DA and Gavin running for mayor, right? So a lot of people said, you know, the mayor's thing was just the two at the ballot on that time. You know, and I got to say, I knew her, but I didn't know her that well. But a bunch of women came up to me and said, you know, if you really care about women, you'll get involved in this race because there's some stuff in that office that's happening around domestic violence and other things. It'd be great to have a woman, you know, as DA. And we had never had a woman DA, you know, before, of course. And so I started helping out on her campaign. I was just a volunteer. And I got to say, it was a long, long shot, you know, and looking back at really everything that she had to overcome to get that race. And then when she won, like, I think that you should join me in the office. And so I did. And it's been an incredible friendship. And she's been an amazing mentor ever since.
Yeah. And you guys have a sort of an interesting, like, you know, like political, professional and personal relationship, which I think is not that uncommon in politics. I want to ask you about one moment early on that was really tough for both of you. I know, which is when Officer Isaac Espinoza was killed. In the Bayview district of San Francisco, this was a police officer who was really well respected. And Kamala had run on this platform of not seeking the death penalty, but she came out very quickly and announced she would not seek it against his then alleged killer. The man was eventually convicted. And I'm just curious because I know that she got a lot of blowback from that, including from Dianne Feinstein, who's now her colleague, and you were on her communication staff. What did you learn from that? Because it was such an interesting, I'm sure you guys were weighing this, like, okay, this is the promise we made in the campaign, but a lot of police were really angry that she said it so quickly.
You know, it was such a hard thing all the way around. He was an amazing cop. He had a wife. You know, he was everything that a cop should be. You know, yeah. He was out there in the Bayview. He was undercover. The assailant was young. It was a tough situation all around. And, you know, looking back, I mean, you know, this is the thing that people often, in fact, we've talked about this, Marisa, of, you know, people seeing Kamala like in her new role now of, maybe, you know, thinking about that there might be some differences. But looking back, I mean, Kamala's always really fought for her ideals. I think looking back, you know, I'll say for myself, I would never want to cause any harm to the Espinoza family. And I think that that's something that was a real struggle. You know, she definitely came into office and we ran on that of a different version of justice, right? And a different paradigm around criminal justice. And now, you know, people talk about recidivism and smart on crime. And it's kind of, but looking back, she was so ahead of her time on that. And I think that there, you know, was a lot that we wanted to, you know, to make sure that as you look at changing the status quo, you know, that said, you know, again, if any harm that we did to the Espinoza family in and the way that that was communicated. Number one, I'd put that more on her communications director, who was me, than her, because that was my responsibility around the communication.
I think that speaks, though, to how communication is not just about the substance. It's about the timing and how you approach it. And I think, I mean, you know, you never can take anything away from a family who's lost somebody. But
yeah, I mean, it was, it was an issue that kind of found us. It was literally on her 100th day in office. I will never forget that, our 100th day in office. It was something that she did feel strongly about for a variety of reasons. And she, communicated those in the campaign. And since that time, certainly, again, we've seen the tide change, as we have on other issues, when people really look at, is it a deterrent? No. Is it something that's really cost prohibitive? Yes. We did get, based on her charging decision, we did get life without parole.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
For that.
And we haven't had any executions in the state in over a decade, so.
Right. And I think that's the thing, and it's, something that, talking with families, those years in the DA's office, and it's so funny, she used to tell me that, because, you guys have been in 850 Bryant, it's just, she always called it a horribly wonderful place, and she's like, you're really going to miss this. It really is going to be one of the best jobs you've ever had, and it's true, although it was an emotionally very, difficult job, too, because you are dealing with people who really experience so much pain, going through that system, yeah. So...
What is it like for you now, knowing her professionally and personally, seeing her on a national stage? She's become a pretty outspoken senator, I would say.
She has. It's been amazing because I've always seen so much promise in her. I mean, literally, working with her those first years in the DA's office, and then, I've been part of her political family ever since. And as Marissa said, also consider her a friend and a mentor. And I, from the day I met her, I knew she was very unique. I think that she has a constellation of talents that are actually really hard to find. She's whip smart. She's strong. She has a backbone. And she's really a gifted communicator. I mean, I look back again on those years, those first years we were in the DA's office, and the way that she really brought people to care about the criminal justice system, myself included. As I said, when she won, I was like, I never want to step foot inside that building. 850, are you kidding me?
But she, for people outside of San Francisco, the Hall of Justice has a sort of, it's not a great place. The building is falling apart itself.
Asbestos used to fall down on my head. Seriously, yeah. I was like, I can never have a baby. So she's a gifted communicator. So she's this constellation of talents, and I think her being in this role, I think we really need her. I think we really need her there.
So we're going to talk about other stuff, but we got to ask, do you think she's going to run 2020?
Yeah.
It's so funny. I'll say what she always says, which is true. She always says, if you look too far ahead of you, you're going to trip, right? And I think that she's just really focusing on her work as a senator, and there's so much to do. I mean, clearly her role on Senate Intelligence and on Senate Judiciary, so I know that she's really focused on that. And like I've said, I feel like we really need her there.
Do you want to go on another presidential campaign? Probably not.
White House communications director?
Presidentials do have a certain, they're so unique. You can only do certain things on them, and they are a blast, but also very difficult. But I've been thrilled that she's been able to, have this larger platform to pursue social justice.
All right. Well, I want to remind our listeners, you are listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos, along with Katie Orr, and our guest is political strategist Debbie Meslow. Deb Meslow. I'm assuming your real name's Deborah, right?
That's right. O-R-A-H. How did you know that?
What if it was like Debifer?
Yeah, right? We could have been wrong. Well, let's talk about your work with women in politics. So Katie has been working on this series called A Long Run, looking with our colleague Miranda Leitzinger, really looking at how many women have been inspired to run or to get involved in politics since 2016. I think it's an interesting moment because it's something, as
Right. I mean, I think the question that I am going to keep in my mind, and I'd be interested to hear what you have to say, is, yes, a lot of people are running now. Is this going to continue past election day?
Right.
What do you think?
Well, let me first say I'm just so thrilled that you're doing this and focusing the attention. So thank you on that, on women running. And because to me, the whole thing around women's leadership, it has to do with all of it, right? It has to do with women running. It has to do with women supporting them. It has to do with really elevating women who work in campaigns, women who are campaign consultants, campaign managers, you know, really those pipelines to leadership. And I personally have really seen such a renaissance in civic re-engagement, right? And I think we see a lot of it, and I'm so thrilled that so many women are running. But I also think there's a sense that the 16 election really clarified that for a lot of people, of just engagement. And that's something else that I really talk to a lot, too, with women of, you know, that running for office is one way to show that leadership, but it's not the only way. And I try really, too, in my networks among my female friends to really elevate other types of ways to get engaged, because I think we need all of that. But that said, you know, I really hope that this energy is sustained. You know, I think we need more women in office. I mean, we're 51% of the population, but we're still not there. We are making great strides in California. I mean, it's an amazing thing. You know, we could have political parity at the state level if some of our great women candidates, such as Alani and Fiona Ma and Betty Yee, win here in San Francisco. You know, this amazing election of London Breed, you know, our second female ever. And so I think we have, you know, a real opportunity. But it is hard for women to run. You know, it's I think it's
difficult.
Yeah,
like, what do you hear? Because, I mean, I know that sort of anecdotally we hear a lot about, you know, being, you know, nervous about putting yourself out there, about wanting to be asked about the family life balance. Are those the same things you're hearing, or are there other concerns? Like, why is it hard to get women involved?
You know, from my perspective, I think, you know, from my perspective, it's because there has been, you know, when you look at the traditional pathways or infrastructure, it hasn't been created around women. Mm-hmm. And that's why I personally think it's so important to have women in charge, you know, so that we can kind of change the dynamics around that.
You know, I will say I was at a press conference the other day with State Senator Holly Mitchell, who chairs the Senate Budget Committee. And the press conference was talking about bills that would really help women, you know, lower income women, things about child care along those lines. And she flat out said, you know, I'm chair of the Senate Budget Committee. That's why, you know, we can get these things in there. And it really hit home the point that, like, you need women in power to advance certain policies.
Yes. I mean, we were talking, you know, you guys both have kids, right? Two of the women I'm helping right now, Buffy Wicks, who's running for assembly, has a small daughter, Susie Loftus, who's going to get in the San Francisco DA's race, three daughters, right? All kind of in tweens, the tween years.
And she has a crazy story about having her first daughter, what, right before she took the bar?
That's right.
Which is insane.
That's right. Incredible. I know. There's still a photo when I think Maureen was like two and Kamala swearing Susie in, you know, as a DA, and like Maureen is like tiny, and now she's 13, right?
And now she might run for president.
She will. We will all be working for her one day. Make no doubt about it. But I look at them, you know, in just the daily lives and what they balance, and I think about, you know, the changes that they'll make from a policy standpoint, you know, from other standpoints, being women. And it's not to say that we don't have great male allies, right? You know, Scott Wiener.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, though, because, like, remember, you know, when Sheryl Sandberg's lean in, one of, like, I think the things people talked about the most is her statement that you need a good partner. And I think about that. I mean, Katie, our husbands are home at night with the kids.
Absolutely.
They got to be there. They're not babysitting, by the way. They're just home with the kids.
They're parenting.
You know, back to Kamala Harris. I mean, she married a very supportive spouse not too long ago.
Yes, that's right.
Do you see that as really important? And, or have you ever seen a woman who, like, didn't do it because of that situation?
I think it's a real challenge. I mean, also for women, you know, we're really experiencing this too, that, you know, you take care of your parents, right? And you have your kids. And that's something to really think about. But I personally think the larger barrier is that these infrastructures have really been created more of who's held power. And that's not to say that people held power has intentionally, you know, kept people out. It's just that I think that when you get to that power structure, then you can create the infrastructure in such a different way. I was just saying, I just heard on, you know, NPR this morning before or tonight before I came about Tammy Duckworth. And she was saying she could not take all of her family leave because she can't vote on the Senate floor with the toddler. And she can't bring her baby in to vote. I mean, that's an example. And she was saying, and I firmly believe this, that we're leaving so much potential on the table. with how our structures are. And I do think that it takes women who leave it, you know, who lead it. I've always said I don't, you know, the idea that politics is local, I think that politics is personal. I've always thought that. And if people are living out their lives, right, and they see something that, again, really is keeping people from reaching their full potential, I think that'll make the change.
So talk to us a little bit about this program Ignite, which you work with. I mean, that actually is trying to train young women to get involved in politics.
That's right. A great woman, Ann Moses, created that because she saw that really we need to start talking with young girls earlier. Right. So we need to start talking to them in high school about political agency, not just running for office. But again, like, you know, your agency really matters, and talking to them about why it matters and specific things. I think so many young people. Right. I was the same way. It's like, oh, God, politics, like snoozerama, you know, but making it, you know, translating that for them and really, you know, getting them engaged. And they train women in their own communities, which I think it's a fantastic model. They have a high school curriculum that they'll launch. And they also have a lot on their website, ignite.org, around talking to your daughter about political agency and what that means, which is everything from, you know, voting to getting involved to if there's something you care about at your school. Susie and I were joking because Maureen ran for class president. Her big thing was the quality of class lunches.
I mean, hey, you got to like go where the
argument is all this time.
Right. I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, I have a list here of all the things you're doing, Debbie. So you're like president of the SF Commission on the Status of Women. You're a founding member of Emerge. I'm sure Kamala Harris still calls you all the time, even though you're not officially working for her. You're chair of the Bay Area Women's Summit in December. Have you ever thought about running for office?
You know, I so appreciate you asking that. I have always just enjoyed the background more, you know, working behind the scenes to help make things happen. I get a lot of joy out of that. And, you know, I've been really fortunate. I mean, I've been really fortunate to work alongside some amazing people. And, you know, I gotta say, I did find, and I've been grateful for the opportunity to work some in local government. I love local government. I really think that's where the rubber meets the road. You know, I find the people that work in local government or run for office locally, like they're problem solvers. So I've really enjoyed that.
Cool. So we like to end on like a fun note. Like, what do you do for fun? What when you're not fielding calls from high powered politicians and encouraging women to run for office?
Well, let's see. So I have surfed for many years.
Awesome.
I do love that. Yes, that has been a fantastic. I am an avid Jayhawk fan. So every NCAA, tournament.
See, this
I
is what we're
going
to get the tweets
that.
About. Not about the political stuff. To me, I'm like, is that football? Basketball.
That's right. A little basketball. Yeah. And then, you know, I still do love trying to create networks of women for change, whatever, you know, however that is and whatever that is. So my newer project is kind of working with women just coming into political campaigns or consulting. Oh. London had, you know, some amazing young women. So does Buffy, of younger women coming in. And so that's always really fun to see.
Well, Debbie Meslow, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for your program, The Long Run. And
thank you.
Lisa, it's always so wonderful to see you.
You
thank
too.
You.
That is going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio.
Yeah, you can check us out anytime. You'll find us at Apple Podcasts, and you can also rate, review, and subscribe to The Breakdown there.
Our engineer is Syl Muller, and Jeremy Siegel directed the show this week.
Scott Schaefer is our senior politics editor and co-host of The Breakdown. He'll be back here next week.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at MLagos.
And I'm Katie Orr. You can find me on Twitter on at one Katie Orr.
That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time. Thanks for being here.